the same kind of anxiety and depression that we've been talking about. Part of it is lack of self-direction and the lack of self-discipline because it's replaced by other direction and other discipline. But also there's just a lot of just scaremongering and just kind of emotional abuse, I think, especially around some of these public issues. You know, Greta Thunberg talks about, she says something like, you've stolen my childhood, saying that to world leaders, really. But really, like the people who most stole her childhood are the people who have terrorized her with these apocalyptic messages. I see it on Twitter a lot, especially like so many young people, they're really anxious about the world literally ending within their lifetime. So part of it is also just because they're so anxious about that this activism is engineered from that too. I guess at least it is better than outright nihilism. Although for some people, like a lot of this apocalyptic rhetoric does kind of cultivate a certain nihilism. At least Greta Thunberg has a cause, even if it's not hers. And hopefully she'll eventually channel that passion into something that is authentically hers. But then lots of kids don't even have anything to channel because, again, their why has been so atrophied.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's waiting.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is November 11th, 2019. And if you're not a part of our Discord community for the university or a supporting listener, you haven't heard from me in a while. I'm sorry about that. So I would just like to say for the record here that our first University event was a huge success. So much so, I am planning an encore presentation for January. So you're going to be hearing more about that soon. Hopefully, it's going to be for a larger and broader audience. So I was pretty close to what I was shooting for as far as enrollment. And one thing that I did notice that was a little troubling for me is that the event was underattended compared to the enrollment, like the number of people participating on Discord or the number of people watching the live stream of the presentations or the Q&As or the informal chats that we did in between. And I was thinking, like, how can I get this to be more people? So when we do it in January, and I would do it sooner than January, but I know the months of November and December are a little busy and sometimes frantic with the holidays. So I figured we'd wait for the new year. And when we do it, I would like to spread it out over three consecutive Saturdays. I know that asking people for like 25 hours of their time packed into 3 days is a lot, but the feedback so far has been great. You can go to ssbuniversity.com/ideas into action if you want to see some of the reviews. And of course, it is now finished and assembled as a digital download. And you can learn more about that on that page as well. So I'm excited. This is like a new territory and definitely something that I should have done long ago, considering how well it went, how energized I was after it was done. And it is also an ever-evolving project. Already, we've had post-events. Moritz Berlin came back and did a Q&A on digital productivity, building a second brain. We talked about Evernote and getting things done and how an ambitious, technologically savvy young man uses these tools in the year 2019. Kevin Cole is coming back. We're lining up more Q&As in the near future as well. As some of you know, I've also been doing a kind of Ask Me Anything discussion format for 2 hours every Tuesday night in Richard Grove's Autonomy Community. And we are about to, starting tomorrow, turn that into more of a production. So if you are a sporting listener, you will have that in your future as well. But I am aware that this is first and foremost a podcast, and I need to do those. So with the success of this first event and the promise of greater success in the future, I've been thinking a lot, and this is obviously, as you can tell, slowed down production, about the future of the content that you're going to be receiving here. I've been having a lot of conversations with new friends and old friends who will be hopefully returning in the near future. But this is definitely an exciting time, and I look forward to being able to tell you more about it. But let's talk about today's show. It is a new voice on a familiar problem. It's a problem we've been talking about off and on for a decade and always worth revisiting when I find somebody who has new and interesting things to say about it. So my guest today is Dan Sanchez, the director of content at the Foundation for Economic Education. Dan and I spent our first meeting talking about how schooling leaves young people and older people who never sufficiently address this problem kind of rudderless. And that is not just professionally, that is also ideologically. This is, in my opinion, a terrible problem for young people today, both in high school and in college, sent out into the world without ever really having time to contemplate, never mind cultivate, their own identity, critical thinking skills, a coherent worldview, and it leaves targets all over them. And those targets are being repeatedly struck by college professors, political operators. And we don't have to go too far back in recent news to see examples of young people being used as tools, as billboards for political purposes. So today, Dan and I address this problem. We talk about some solutions for how people, young and old, can get their rudders back. We go at this through an educational lens and also a parental lens. Don't worry, Dan's a parent, so I defer to him on that. And I'm happy with how this first conversation turned out. I look forward to collaborating more with Dan in the future. He blogs regularly at Fee. That website is fee.org. And there is a link to some of his relevant blogs in the show notes. Thank you so much for your time today to listen to this, everybody. I will try to close out the year with some more regular podcast content for you. Always feel free to post in the Facebook group if you have ideas for shows or guests. Please don't forget to at least just go take a look at ssponiversity.com/ideas into action. Have a look at what we have put together. By we, I mean me, Zach Slayback, Moritz Berling, Steve Patterson, Scott Hambrick, Kevin Cole, Richard Grove, Jay Dyer, Michael Malice, Tom Woods in Kevin Geary on how you can become more skilled at the acquisition, assimilation, and presentation of new information. Now, if you decide this is something you want to obtain for yourself, yes, right now you are watching something that happened in the past, but your purchase will also grant you access to the Encore presentation happening in January. Again, that is SSP University. Just spell it university. .com/ideas into action. On that page, you'll find a little more detail about each of the presentations. There's a table of contents just so you can get a sense of what time commitments different presentations require. And recently, somebody challenged me to explain the whole Ideas into Action Summit in one sentence. So there's a video doing just that. That video is 1 minute long, and it's going to be one of the best minutes of your day. When we did this, the live energy was so great, packed with unexpected delights. We did Q&As with Scott Hambrick, Zach Slayback, and Michael Malice even returned on very short notice to help us close out the event for about an hour and a half of Q&A. Discomfort Zone co-host Andrew also came and sat in on some of this right here in the studio, and we wound up, this wasn't part of the plan, but I'm so glad it happened, we wound up inserting at least one, maybe one and a half to two full-length discomfort zones into the 3-day weekend, I also did a solo Q&A every day at lunch for about an hour. All of that is available in the downloadable version, and more content is being added to that as we speak. And if you just want updates about this Encore event coming in January or future events, go to sspuniversity.com and sign up to receive updates. I'll be happy to send them. And in closing, I'm compelled to say this because I do really strive for honesty and like a reasonable amount of openness and authenticity with thousands of strangers. I wish I could just come on here every week or whenever and hoot and holler about how great everything is. But life is not without its challenges. And I think the combination of those challenges and the contemplation of new directions has definitely slowed podcast production down over the last month or so. And I do apologize for that. But I would also just like to say that I am very, very grateful. I know I'm always asking you guys to do things to help the show, but I'm very, very grateful that you are just willing to give me your time whenever a new show comes out, whether you're a new listener or an old listener. From the bottom of my heart, thank you so much. And I will talk to you again soon. Dan, how you doing?
Hi, Brett. I'm great. How are you?
I'm excellent. I'm happy to have you. There's so many different directions we can go in today. I'm going to try and focus on between 1 and 3 blogs that you have written for fee. Dan, by the way, everybody, is the director of content at the Foundation for Economic Education. I will tell you this, Dan, in 10 years of doing this show, the only sponsor I ever had was fee. Because they asked me, and I was so honored when they did, that I ran ads. God, I don't remember what it was. It was a couple years ago. It was for young people's economic training camp. I was so pleased to do it because in my formative years, when I was being introduced to this philosophy, Fee was definitely instrumental. So you're also the editor at fee.org, and you either are or used to be a writing coach with our friends at Praxis. You still doing that?
Yes, I am. It's been 3 years now.
Awesome. Most recent guest in my podcast feed, All Praxis Guys, Zach was my last guest. And then I was actually down there. I was down in South Carolina and we did a little roundtable with Isaac and TK. So I'm a big promoter of Praxis for free all the time because I think they're like the perfect embodiment of so much of what I hope education can look like in the future. And that's something that we're going to talk about today.
Totally agree.
But because we've never talked before, I wanted to hear a little bit about your background, your philosophical journey leading up to the work you currently do with Fee. I know we only have an hour today, but I'm happy to continue this conversation. So I don't care if this takes a half an hour, because who knows what directions we might go in here. But tell us all about yourself.
Sure. So I've long been really interested in education. At first, I had pretty much the opposite views of what I have now. I minored in education at UC Berkeley. At the time, I was all about government schooling. If anything, that like I thought private schools were a problem, and that like schooling wasn't egalitarian enough. And so I was all about like top-down solutions, standards in school. I was all about like with the actual curriculum and like the discipline. I was all about strict discipline and strict rules and strict consequences for in order to like mold young people's behavior. And I was also not a libertarian at the time either. But then after I graduated, it was in a class at UC Berkeley. Actually, I took a extended learning class because I was still living in the area. And I was working in education at the time. I was working at a science museum. We were teaching hands-on science workshops at schools, and it was a museum that kids could come to. And while I was working there, I took this public policy class, and it really was my first introduction to libertarian thought that I kind of wasn't even really aware of it. And this, the professor himself wasn't a libertarian, but it was just one of the policy options that he presented. Hmm. And once I learned that it even existed, I was pretty much enamored right away. Like, I've always kind of been a latent libertarian. It was just a matter of like learning about it in the first place. And then that eventually gradually became an interest in libertarian approaches to education and just a realization of how public schools, how government schools are really bad for kids. And an interest in homeschooling. And then especially when my daughter was an infant, I got really passionate about learning more about homeschooling philosophies in depth and discovered Montessori, discovered people like John Holt and Peter Gray and Carrie McDonald. And that just became a huge influence on me. And eventually I just became interested in unschooling and really devoted to unschooling and alternative education.
So you mentioned Peter Gray, you mentioned Carrie McDonald, John Holt. What about specifics as far as like what you were reading, or maybe even if you have any, and if you can remember them, some impactful moments or revelations in that process for you?
Probably the one... There was one article that I remember made a huge difference. And surprisingly, it was Herbert Spencer.
Ooh.
And yeah, he's not really known as an education philosopher. Like he's known as a political philosopher, a classical liberal. But he had this one essay where he talked about natural consequences in the life of the child and how imposing artificial consequences really prevents a child from learning, and how children need to learn from like the natural consequences, good or bad, from their behavior in order to actually adapt and to mature and to grow up. And the way he put it was so convincing that that particular article played a big role.
Yeah, absolutely. Like as a former teacher myself, I don't know if I was able to articulate it so clearly in my own thoughts, but I remember having to play these enforcement roles in the various educational, finger quotes, educational settings that I worked in back then. The question would have been something like, are we teaching cause and effect, or are we teaching kids that adults are annoying and petty? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it seemed like a lot of the time. What kind of came through in the process of these artificial consequences was resentment, which was just poisonous to any kind of partnership an educator would hope to have before. You know, unfortunately for too many of us, I mean, I was in a boarding school. It was a high stress environment, a lot of behaviorally special needs kids. So people got burned out really fast. But I felt like we were just projecting resentment, making it a hostile work environment and a hostile learning environment, which is not a learning environment.
Yeah.
So you caught my eye with a very short piece you wrote, and it led to me looking through your archives on Fee and reading some more of your work. But I wanted to talk today about a problem and a solution presented in this blog called School Has Robbed Young People of Their Why. You know, like I said, I've been doing this show a long time. And in the beginning, it was very problems focused, right? It was quite negative. I had a lot of negative things to say about what was, as like a new libertarian, I had lots of rants about what was happening in public schools at all levels and in higher education, even though higher education seemed like less of a focus at the time. I'm actually, after really trying to shift content in a more positive direction, now contemplating a strategy where we go back to exploring problems, because there are so many things happening in the schools today and with young people today in the culture that I never even could have dreamed of, you know, when I started doing this in 2009. And I think a lot of it is worth revisiting. But that being said, I'm always interested in a fresh take on the problem. You talk about this need is something that I've become very aware of in young people and their behavior over the last year, needing to rebuild these rudders. School broke. That's the path to them being able to find their way, to find their purpose in life. And I just wanted to talk, first of all, about your observations that led to you putting that in print.
Yeah, well, mostly it's observing just the struggles that so many young people are having these days. That I've read so many stories about how depression and anxiety rates are at just record levels, and how it just seems that young people just really feel lost. That a lot of young people, that they don't know what to do with their lives. They don't know what to do with their careers. Oftentimes they have a failure to launch where they still depend on their parents. And even when they do land a job, that they struggle with finding meaning in their job and worry so much about like whether it's right for them. And they don't know what they want out of relationships, that there's just so much ennui and anxiety and depression. And I really think that it traces back to just a lack of being able to set one's own direction. And I trace that back to school, because really it's self-direction that they're missing. And it's because they don't have practice in developing that self-direction, because it's always been other direction that, especially now, because like you said, it seems that things have been getting worse. And I think it's because schools have become even more regimented, and helicopter parenting has become even more of a problem, where so much of children's lives are directed by authority figures, whether in school or at home, or in their in their structured activities after school or on weekends. Like, whereas at least before there was some at home and after school and somewhat in school, that there was some agency and some self-direction. Now, often in an effort to remedy the failings of school, they just double down on what was the problem in the first place by just imposing more externally provided direction and structure. But the problem is, what happens after they graduate? What happens after that externally provided direction and structure is pulled out? Well, their muscle of developing their own direction and structure has completely atrophied. Yeah. And so with that, when the external props are pulled out, and the crutches are pulled out from under them, and they don't have the strength to stand on their own, that it makes sense that they feel so lost.
Absolutely. So let's focus on that for a minute. And then I want to change directions, because I think there's another more potentially damaging, definitely nefarious manifestation of this problem that we're talking about. But let's stick to this track first, which is more about career and finding purpose. I have felt like there has been a trend in parents outsourcing more of this responsibility to the school, like definitely over my lifetime and even over my career as an educator. It would be, and again, these are only anecdotes, these are only snapshots. Maybe when I wasn't involved, these parents were very attentive to their children. But I used to work in a really competitive area in Needham, Massachusetts. So lots of kids who were AP, Ivy League bound. And I would do academic tutoring, I would do college consulting, and I would do primarily SAT tutoring. That was sort of the bread and butter of it, probably still is the bread and butter of any tutoring business. And I would just kind of be led off to a room with this kid to do the educational activities, kind of as an enforcement agent for the school. But I saw very, very little parental. I was just like another staff member in that process that the parents had entirely outsourced. So there's that, but then there's this helicopter thing that's also happening. And maybe you could help me square that. Because you're right, these kids had their lives micromanaged between school and tutoring and extracurricular activities and building a decent college application. So all aspects of their lives from like 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. were managed by adults with very little say from them, from my observations. So we have the helicoptering, but we also have, it almost seems like more faith being put in the school or less responsibility being taken by parents. Do you see that?
Yes. Although I think that the way you characterized it is that you were kind of an enforcement arm of the school, that you were kind of deputized by this, a deputy of the school. And I see that as being true of parents too, that yeah. Parents have basically become like deputized teachers, that so much of the relationship between the parents and the kids is basically making sure that they do their homework, making sure that they're performing well enough in school, making sure that they do the extracurricular activities. And even when parents are super involved in their kids' lives, it's on behalf of the school, and it's not an authentic relationship.
And the school often comes between parents and their children in that way, when the parents feel like they have to play that enforcement role. And that was another battle. And this was sort of as I was phasing that part of my career out of my life, because it became very frustrating. Parents, like, school teaches obedience, conformity. And I would say that the outcome of those two lessons is, unfortunately for too many people, a kind of permanent apathy. And you could see it in the parents as well, where there would be this resignation of, well, I guess if that's what the teacher says. I mean, I heard that more than once, resigning their whole family to something that wasn't best for them or for their child. That was a pretty common occurrence. So the other angle here that I've really noticed through a series of news events in the last year and a half, and I said that this was more nefarious and potentially more damaging. Obviously, you know, in that blog, I remember you had a Mises quote, human action is purposeful behavior, right? And if you spend 15,000 hours robbed of an opportunity to pursue purposeful behavior, there's going to be ugly consequences of that for sure. But people who are in high school primarily, and I would say it's probably true in middle school, as they start to feel like adults, they want that independence. That's natural. They crave a kind of autonomy and an ability to self-direct. And we've seen a kind of exploitation of that, I would say, politically. So the two examples I paid a lot of attention to, like in 2018 and this year, obviously the fallout from the Parkland shooting, right, where all of those kids were sort of mobilized into basically anti-Second Amendment activism. And one that we've seen more recently was these climate strikes led by that poor girl from overseas.
Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, you know, basically just turned into, like so many other children, a kind of political prop. You know, and I've seen this with his children as young as 2 or 3 years old at rallies for some cause, holding signs they can't even read about issues they certainly don't understand. But just if we want to focus in on high school kids, these are people who are searching for purpose. They're searching for meaning. They day in and day out lead these lives that are not self-directed. So my theory about this is, when they're given a chance, right? Like those Parkland kids were told, "You're saving the world." And the climate thing is an even better example of this. That's like literally saving the world. You are on the right side in a battle of good versus evil. And I could see a lot of kids I got very annoyed with, especially around the Parkland thing, like feeling like they didn't really understand the issues. But if that was me and I was 17 years old and I was given that opportunity to go on television or to be a spokesperson or to be the face of what I believed to be a righteous cause, with the wisdom that I had at the time, I would have taken it in a second, and I probably wouldn't have looked back. And it's interesting that one of those kids from Parkland, his name's Cameron Caskey, actually, before he even turned 18 years old, was able to go through a period of self-reflection and say, yeah, I was really overzealous. You know, I took a really unhelpful tone with a lot of the way we were trying to put that message out. I thought that was a really promising development for him. But there are plenty of kids who political operators are happy to use, happy to tap into their angst and use it for political purposes. So I'd like to just hear your thoughts on that, because I think that, especially considering the stress and the division that is causing, and exacerbated by other political things and other technological things like social media, bringing kids into that arena, because it is a counterfeit way of satisfying a real need that they have, a need to make meaning, a need to feel purposeful, I think is a bit of a disturbing trend.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. And I also think it's an artificial need to an extent, because I think that the same kind of anxiety and depression that we've been talking about, part of it is, as we've said the lack of self-direction and the lack of self-discipline, because it's replaced by other direction and other discipline. But also there's just a lot of just scaremongering and just kind of emotional abuse, I think, especially around some of these public issues that, you know, Greta Thunberg talks about. She says something like, you've stolen my childhood, saying that to corporations and saying that to, you know, people who don't, well, to world leaders, really. But really, like, the people who most stole her childhood are the people who have terrorized her with these apocalyptic messages. I see it on Twitter a lot, especially, like, so many young people, they're really anxious about the world literally ending within their lifetime. So part of it is also just because they're so anxious about that this activism is engineered from that too. At least, I guess at least it is better than outright nihilism. Although for some people, like, a lot of this, a lot of the environmental apocalyptic rhetoric does kind of cultivate a certain nihilism. But at least, I don't know, at least Greta Thunberg has a cause, even if it's not hers. And hopefully she'll eventually channel that passion into something that is authentically hers. But then there's lots of kids who don't even have anything to channel because, again, their why has been so atrophied.
Absolutely. And I think her situation, now, like, obviously it's interesting, like, somebody is useful for a period and then they just disappear. Like, I haven't heard anything about her in months. I'm not saying I never will hear anything about her again, but, you know, she shows up just like an advertising campaign. This person that we're supposed to be so invested in and so proud of shows up, flashes in the pan, and then just disappears. And I often wonder what happens to these young people when they are cast into the spotlight like that, and then they develop this, again, this artificial sense of importance around something they don't really believe in. And they're sitting ducks for it as well, because it's not like they're being taught critical thinking skills in school. It's very, very easy for them to buy into this kind of ideological programming because they, you know, they don't understand logical fallacies. They don't understand rhetorical trickery. And the organization of the forces in the world into good and evil, the darkness and the light, that's a very convenient model for young people. And I certainly see why they embrace it. I was fully embracing that, you know, just a lack of nuance through almost every stage of coming to some kind of new idea, right? Whether I was in college and learning this sort of revisionist history, who are the good guys and bad guys, right? Whenever there's like a new theater of discovery, the question is who's good and who's bad. It's the simplest way to basically fool yourself into thinking it makes sense. And if people are not given the skills of how to learn for themselves, they're just easy to hit targets over and over again for these kinds of things.
Yeah.
That's what I see happening. Well, let's talk about some solutions for this. You end the article talking about how kids can get their rudders back, right? They've lost their rudders through continuous training in obedience. And I would add the social environment of school adds conformity to that as well. A lot of these lessons are implicit, but they're consistent. They're never defined, which I think makes them even more dangerous. If kids do resist them, they get in trouble. And if they don't resist them, they also get in trouble later on, right? If they're just obedient conformists, like, trouble awaits in that case as well. So here they are in this situation as a result of these lessons, rudderless, purposeless. What are your ideas for helping them get that rudder back, get that rudder working?
I think it's useful to start even earlier and think about how those rudders are developed naturally in the first place, even if they're not broken at all. And that is by the inherent curiosity of children.
Yeah.
And their inherent obsessiveness. When it comes to developing a why, like, kids are naturally attuned to developing their why, that they're naturally obsessive, that, you know, kids, you know, famously get obsessed about Pokemon, about certain toy series, certain doll series, certain video games, just certain activities. That's often seen as like a bad thing, because the norm is that, well, people are supposed to be well-rounded. And so you can't be too obsessed with one thing, that needs to be curtailed so that you can have like a balanced curriculum. But that is really counterproductive, because obsession, even though you're not going to use like Pokemon, you know, as a career necessarily, obsession itself is like a meta skill. It's like getting so devoted and dedicated and immersed in something that you want to learn everything about it, that you want to just master it. That is a mindset that is transferable to anything else.
Right.
And that's the natural way that kids develop their why, is that they develop the propensity to get passionate about things. And eventually that propensity can translate into being passionate about life direction, about one's career and one's meaning in life, and what they want to get out of their relationships. And a big part of it is also emulating adults or older kids who themselves are pursuing their whys. The fallacy is that the only role that adults and can play is by setting the why for the child. But just by seeing adults passionately pursuing their own interests, that's what kids emulate. That's what kids look up to. That's another just natural inherent propensity of children, is that they admire independent elders who are pursuing their own whys with passion, and they want to emulate it. They want to develop that kind of independence themselves. And so adults really serve best as something to emulate and not something to dictate. And so I think that's the natural way that kids develop self-direction and self-discipline. So then it becomes a question of like, okay, well, what if they didn't have that kind of an upbringing? What if instead they were sent through the Pavlovian hoop jumping of school, where all that they had a chance to do was just learn how to be obedient and learn how to follow externally provided direction and structure? Then what? Really, like, it's just a matter of de-schooling oneself, of realizing what the problem is. And that's why I think this kind of message is not only valuable for teachers and for kids and for parents, but it's also just valuable for young adults.
Yes.
To know the origin of some of the struggles that they're having, because then it's a matter of de-schooling yourself. You know, that's a whole other subject in and of itself, but it starts with knowing how the problem started in the first place.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that's something that we've done a couple of shows on the de-schooling concept. But what do you think the key features of that are? Like, let's say for somebody who's been through the schooling process, right? Because that's probably the most common case of a need for de-schooling. Certainly there are kids who are pulled out of school by their parents after 8th grade, after 10th grade, after 3rd grade. Most of us go all the way through. Most of us go to college, right? And then at some point, and there's certainly a lot of these people in my audience, we realize that our education had not only some shortcomings, not only left us with some blind spots, but it had some very subtle but persistently damaging kinds of effects on us. So if there were, I'm not asking you to make a checklist, but if there were some highlights of a conscious de-schooling process for young adults and adults who are coming to these realizations, what do you think is important about that?
Well, I'm not endorsing this because I haven't gone through it myself, but it's the kind of thing that I think young people can do to de-school themselves is what Jordan Peterson calls self-authoring.
Yeah.
And that is like there's past authoring and future authoring, where you kind of like think about your life as a story, and like what were some of like the big themes of that story, and what can you learn from that story. And to future author is to really envision your life. Like the way he puts it, that like envisioning a hell and a heaven, that like if all of your vices that you can see were able to just run rampant, like where would you be, you know, 1 year down the road, 5 years down the road, or if you were able to like accentuate all of your virtues, what could you attain 1 year down the road, five years down the road? And I think that kind of articulating one's own life story, both in the past and in the future, is one way of sort of taking back responsibility for your own life and undoing like how you were forced to abdicate that responsibility through the schooling process. That's the kind of thinking that like we've just been trained like not to do anymore, because it's not really up to us. Like, you know, what we do 1 year, 5 years down the road when we're in sixth grade, it's like, well, you just follow the program. But once there is no program, it's like you've got to figure that out yourself. And really it all comes down to articulating it some way. And one of the best ways, and the way that Jordan Peterson has people who go through his self-authoring program, is basically journaling. It's just basically, you know, writing down these plans and reflections about yourself and your life. I think that's part of it. And the two things that are so missing because of school are self-direction and self-discipline. And the self-direction part, that's, you know, that can be provided by sort of that like vision thinking. The self-discipline part, I think, can be provided by really paying attention to one's habits. Habits are something that like we just oftentimes we've cultivated from school, and it's just something that we're kind of stuck with. But habits can be hacked. And there are a lot of really great books on like habit formation and how to alter your habits. But basically, if you can alter your habits, then that is the path to self-structure and self-discipline. And so I think that I think of those as really the two components of deschooling.
Excellent. Easier to build a new habit or to break a bad habit? What do you think?
I've never thought of that.
Like, I certainly still have things that I do in my life that I don't love that are sort of these autopilot features, right? And this is actually part of my last conversation with Zach. We were doing, and we will be continuing, a series on self-discipline. And the title of the show that I did with Zach was Automating Self-Discipline. So, you know, we have like a kind of conscious actor, and a lot of us also have an autopilot. And the conversation was like how to merge those two. Like the conscious actor, the do-gooder, the person who loves and respects self. How do you put that on autopilot? Right? Because a lot of times the unthinking autopilot is where we get into trouble. That was a feature of the conversation. And I've read a lot on habit. And one of the takeaways just generally from that reading would be adding new habits have a way of crowding, like building new habits and embracing new habits and starting to feel good and feel the rewards of new habits can actually help crowd some of those bad habits out. When you see the undeniable reward of something new that you've added, and there's only so much time and so much energy that you have to devote to habit, that can actually be a way of erasing some of the bad ones.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So
I think a big part of it is I'm really fascinated by the book, The Power of Habit. He talks about habit loops, and habit loops are the cue for the habit, which then triggers the routine, which then generates a reward. And the way he puts it is that the trick is to keep the same cue and the same basic reward, or at least an analog of that reward, and to swap out the routine, and so that's a lot more feasible than just trying to just quit a bad habit cold turkey. Is that like okay, well, try to get a substitute reward from like a good habit somehow. And so I would just really recommend that book.
Can you think of an example of that, even one that he gives in the book?
Sure. I might need to jog my memory a bit. There was one where he talks about his own success that he had was when he had a bad habit of eating a cookie. He'd go down to the cafeteria and buy a cookie in the afternoon, and he was just gaining a lot of weight just from that one cookie, like extra cookie every single day. So he tried, like, you know, putting a post-it as just like a reminder, like no more cookies kind of thing, but that never worked. But what did work is that he realized that what made the habit so powerful was that when he would go down to eat the cookie, he'd also chat up his coworkers that were also down in the cafeteria at the same time. And so what he did is that, like, when he felt that craving for a cookie, then he just like went over to some other part of the office and just chatted with his coworkers there. And that's what did the trick finally.
Yeah. So I think it's also the conscious, you know, this merges with journaling nicely, identifying through living consciously, what are the needs I'm trying to get met? What are the discomforts that I'm struggling with that this thing quiets, this bad habit, and then finding another way to do that. Man, when those words come out of my mouth, it sounds so easy. I understand that it's not. But, you know, trying to raise your conscious awareness of that as much as possible is obviously a huge step in the right direction. And, you know, just back to the de-schooling topic, a lot of this conversation that I've had was kids transitioning out of public school into some kind of self-directed education environment, having to go through a process of becoming aware of all the bad habits, not that they built, but that were sort of built into them, is, I think, a really important feature of de-schooling that perfectly relates to what we're talking about.
Yes, definitely.
So you're a parent. A lot of this process that we're discussing as far as, you know, being good guides and helping kids fix their rudders, if, you know, there are people out there who are the parents of school children, trusting kids to be able to self-direct is a considerable challenge. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that as well, whether it's challenges you've had in doing it, challenges you've observed, that letting go. Like, it's you wrote a blog called Parents Can Trust Kids to Teach Themselves. Mm-hmm. In it, you said this is an easy thing to do, and it's also the hardest thing to do. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that.
Yeah, I think that's from a John Holt quote. Yeah, I really think that we can trust kids because of that innate curiosity. That there's the fear is that if we trust kids, then they will just do nothing, that they'll just waste their time, that they'll just indulge in whims and that they'll never make anything out of themselves.
Right.
But that gives really short shrift to human nature, because if humans had that propensity, then we wouldn't have gone very far. We would have like failed as a species. But humans have a way. Peter Gray talks about like the evolutionary basis that it's actually an evolutionary adaptation to want to seek out enriching experiences that help you become more independent. And so we can trust in that propensity. And so the way Peter Gray talks about it, that in hunter-gatherer tribes, that would manifest in kids seeing the adults using the tools of their people, like bows and arrows and knives and other kinds of more simple tools, and want to use them too, just want to emulate them in the use of them and become like the role models that they see. And there's this fascination with it, like that they just naturally have. If we surround kids with similar role models using the modern tools of today, well, you know, kids see that the way that adults thrive and around them is by using these important tools and developing and utilizing these important skills like literacy, like technology, like numeracy. And kids want to emulate that. And so if they see that around them, they're going to want to pursue it themselves. And it's only when the only alternative to doing things that don't interest them at all, like just like forced to do worksheets and forced to do things that they don't see as relevant to them at the moment, is just mindless entertainment, then, or what seems to us to be mindless entertainment, that's what they're going to pursue. But if they, as long as they have a rich environment with lots of role models and access to lots of tools, you can trust that they are going to use those role models and tools.
Okay. So like when you started down that road, I was actually preparing a challenge that I don't even know if we have time for. We've got about 10 minutes left. But Peter Gray took me to school on this, for lack of a better expression. He turned me around on video games, right? And I was doing like half devil's advocate. I've obviously observed beneficial outcomes of that type of engagement in young people, and some outcomes that did not seem so beneficial. And I've given lots of examples on my show of both in the past. But, you know, my contention was that, like, look, we can talk about, you know, the evolutionary history of human beings. That's fine. I kind of feel, and maybe this is cynical, like a lot of that has been rewired in just the last 10 years, right? With how kids are growing up today and what they're exposed to and not having good role models for these things. So that challenge still exists, even though I ultimately do wind up agreeing with you there. And like I said, Peter Gray helped straighten me out on that when we talked about the benefits of technology. But it doesn't mean there isn't a lot of misuse of it. And it doesn't mean that, like, you go into any bar or restaurant and I feel like half the adults in there who could be role models are bent down at the neck like this, staring at their phones, you know, even if they're with other people. So do you have any ideas or actual examples of specifics on how that is being modeled for young people in positive ways? I mean, I'm sure if we sat here for a minute, I could think of a ton of them too, but I'd like to hear what you'd have to say about that.
Yeah, well, I do agree with Peter Gray about video games, because even if the amount of time that kids might be spending on video games isn't the best out of all possible worlds, like, given the options that they're allowed to have, oftentimes that's like the best option available to them. And that's why they pursue it. Because as Peter Gray puts it, that is one of these virtual worlds that they have access to are one of the few areas where they have any kind of agency, any kind of volition, any kind of like exploration, and that isn't supervised, like especially now that, like, not only in school, but even outside of school, that kids are constantly in adult supervised overseen activities, and they're constantly being monitored and constantly being checked and corrected. Like, the virtual world of the video game is often the only escape from that. It's the only realm where they're not being monitored by adults, and where they can they can have free interplay with other kids and have rivalries, and it's messy, and there's social dynamics where they're being mean to each other, and instead of having an adult swoop in and correct one person, it's like they have to work it out themselves, and that they have challenges that they're trying to overcome, and they have sort of like natural pecking orders, like natural hierarchies of competence that they're developing, and all this rich dynamic stuff can actually happen and not be crushed down by like the arbitrary authority and the stultifying control of adults like it is in the real world.
Absolutely. So I totally agree with you. And I think when I was talking to Peter about this, there might have been some equivocation on video games, where I'm saying that word and he is obviously receiving that and understanding all the benefits of it. And what I'm thinking about is screens, right? I'm thinking about kids holding phones. I'm thinking about kids holding iPads. I was absolutely horrified one day when I took my 4-year-old niece's iPad and just stared at it for 10 minutes. And it is the most, there's like this kids version of YouTube where it's just these other kids who don't really speak. They just kind of giggle and open candy. And she was just so fixated on this thing. And I had a very, very difficult time imagining how that could be good. So I guess the distinction that's worth making is between active and passive, right? There's plenty of passive screen activity that I think obviously is detrimental. But the active screen activity that you're describing, I mean, I guess short of like getting outside and moving around and doing other types of play, like, you know, in a social environment, far superior to being pinned into a desk and doing work that you can't find meaning in.
Yeah, right. So that's the whole caveat of all of this, is that, like, if they could actually go outside and play and have unsupervised free play with other kids, that probably would be better and would be more enriching. But again, it all goes back to trust, because if a more enriching alternative was available to them, you can trust that they would gravitate to that because it would be more rich, because you know, you would have the physicality of it and learning how to negotiate physical risk and rough and tumble play and like the subtleties of social dynamics that you can only have in face-to-face interactions and those kinds of things. If kids had that available to them, I really think that they would choose that, at least a lot of the time, over video games. And there's a great passage in Carrie McDonald's book, Unschooled, where she talks about that actual happening in some unschooled programs, where overdoing it in screen time isn't as much of an issue because there's so much rich voluntary experience available to kids as an alternative. And I would say even with some of the screen time that we think of as passive, YouTube can be pretty active in the sense of kids choosing videos. Kids can like pick up a lot of culture. Like my daughter likes YouTube. She also likes video games. She also likes playing with friends. But I've noticed that she's learned a lot from YouTube. And it started with some of those unboxing videos that you've talked about and that seem, especially to adult eyes, as inane and, right, and vapid. But you know, there are things that they're picking up that we don't necessarily pick up on. And then eventually it evolved into like ever more sophisticated videos that she was interested in. And now she's always blowing me away with like things like cultural references and words and facts that like I know I never taught her, and I know her mom never taught her, that she picks up from YouTube.
Well, that's an awesome final word about trust then, isn't it? Like, all right, you know what you're doing with these candy unboxing videos. We'll see where it goes. And it paid off. I like that story. So that does actually open up a whole a bunch of different directions we could go in there. But we're out of time for today. I really appreciate the conversation. It was great to finally have you on the show. If people want to learn more about your writing or your work, is fee.org the best place to go?
I have an archive, so if you just search Dan Sanchez and fee.org, it'll come right up.
And education is just one of the subjects. You talk a lot about culture. It seems like a bulk of your work was on economics. So yes, People are interested in those subjects, go check it out. And Dan also used to do a podcast called FeeCast, which was kind of like a roundtable, very, very informal, fun to listen to shows. And the archives of that are available in any podcatcher. So check that out as well.
And I also wanted to plug one particular fee offering that especially for that I think is really powerful for deschooling. And that is T.K. Coleman's Revolution of One video series, podcast, Motivational Mondays, really inspiring stuff. And for parents, the Liberate Ed newsletter by Carrie McDonald,
yes,
is a tremendous resource.
Excellent. Well, Dan, I look forward to continuing this conversation sometime in the near future.
Me too, Brett. Thank you so much. We've got time.